You know, if we ever write the Mykonos book, and I have one podcast that has a book, and I think
might as well have two.
One day I want to have two. Yeah. The way that we structure it is around particular threads that have developed over the years. Now, I think like you could have a chapter that's called Politics, What a Concept.
Man, you and I are on the same wavelength. I've already started writing it in my head. There'll be a chapter called Full Spectrum Dominance, Hollywood at the End of History. We'll talk about True Lies, shit like that.
There should be a chapter that's about kind of like IP, Space Jam, A New Legacy. You talk about
Ready Player One,
Flash. But then how does that chapter relate to, and does it flow into the chapter that's about stuff like Cube and Dark City and The Matrix Resurrections and movies like that that are kind of about...
That would be its own chapter.
Plato's allegory of the cave wall, you know?
Right.
Those sorts of movies. And then all those movies that are sort of like post-partisan documentaries, like... was the movie called Both Sides Now, or was the episode?
No, that was just the episode.
Stole that
from Joni Mitchell, that one.
The Reunited States, is that what the movie was called?
Well, yeah.
There were two.
It's so funny because there's The Reunited States, and then there's another movie that's like the same movie. We had Alex Shepard on to talk about one of those, and like one of them was made by some like I don't know, some shitty, like, was it literally the guy from Home Depot? I can't remember.
That's right. And in fact, he was in it.
It's like semi-autobiographical. There's
a whole montage of him like suiting up like he's fucking Batman.
Yeah.
And there's a caption that's like, you know, Howard, whatever, change maker, philanthropist, global leader.
Yeah. I can never remember, you know, which of those films is, because one of them also, wasn't the other one, was produced by
Van Jones
and Meghan McCain, friends of the show. Those kind of like, post-political films, that would be a whole chapter. And like
the intro chapter has to be about Michael Moore. And I would like to
And I would like to... The Slacker Uprising chapter.
Yeah, and if anything, I would like to be kinder to Michael Moore than we perhaps were in those opening episodes, because I'm more sympathetic to him than I used to be. Yeah, I mean, really, you look at the lonely fight that he fought, and the Slacker Uprising tour, it was misguided, spoke to a misguided streak in him, but for God's sake, the man was fumbling around in the dark.
Yeah, he did not have a lot of allies at that point, you know. It was, you know, him and Janine Garofalo trying to hold back the neocon hordes, you know?
And those two were just on their own in their clumsy way, were so fucking hated. Like,
that's crazy.
Like Team America World Police. It's crazy to think back about that movie where it's like, well, on the one hand, you've got, you know, the American Imperial State. And on the other hand, you've got a half dozen kind of annoying lib celebrities like Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
And we're going to fucking kill them. We're going to kill Tim Robbins.
I like Tim Robbins.
I'm saying annoying by Matt and Trey.
No, I understand. You know, okay, we're in the writer's room here. Let's talk this out a little more. So I've thought about this too, and I think that there's a couple possible sort of templates for what this book could be. One, obviously, is something like The Chapo Guide to Revolution, where I thought, you know, I was impressed by that book when I first read it because it was more of a real book than I expected. You know, they did actually write a book, and good for them, I say. But they also did what I was expecting the book to do, which was sort of create something that is, sort of like a cross-section of the show and you know, something that lays out in prose kind of the universe conceptually and thematically that they've created. Another possible template, honestly, something I think a lot about is film after film. Where
the Jay Hoberman book.
Yeah, of course. The great book by Jay Hoberman where, you know, it's really just a collection of different film reviews he's done, although it also has some essays in it, right? There's that great one at the beginning, The Myth of Total Cinema, stuff like that. It occurs to me that we could do exactly the structure you and I were just talking about, where there are these chapters where the parameters are these conceptual ones, full spectrum dominance, IP movies, politics, what a concept, etc. And those could take the form of maybe like short essays at the beginning and then and like reviews of each film.
Capsule reviews
sort of in the way that Hoberman does, where, you know, he'll write 800 to 1200 words about something, but what he's really doing is he's situating them within kind of a wider context. So we would sort of do that, and, you know, if it was the full spectrum dominance chapter, you know, we talk about True Lies and like what it means, how it relates to the, you know, parameters we've set out in whatever essay comes before it. So that'd be one idea. I'll tell you a third template I thought of, which is I think maybe a little closer to some of the things that you've done, perhaps a kind of more like zine informed type of thing. There's that old guide. What's it called? The Guide to Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, the Amazing Colossal Episode Guide.
Right. The Amazing Colossal Episode Guide. So, you know, I've thought about like, it would be really fun to do that for Michael and us. Now, I don't think it's just beyond our bandwidth, our labor power to literally do an episode guide for every single episode. But I mean, we could go through and we could pick like, we could do 20% of the movies and we could write like, yeah, like little short short episodes. And yeah, it could just be a sort of reference guide for the show and, you know, in its signature moments, something like that. What do you think? Where do you come down on this question? How would you structure the book, and how promising do you think each of these potential structures are?
I want to do something that stands on its own as kind of a book, something that has, right, has a little bit of intellectual heft, and something that is basically like kind of takes the movies, not so much an episode guide, something that takes the movies as a jumping off point to create a, okay, almost 500 episodes. Like, where are we now? Yeah. What are the conclusions that we've reached?
Yeah.
And narratively sort of weaving it together is sort of the, not just the evolution of the show, but like the times themselves.
Here's another question for you. I mean, something I've thought about a lot is, you know, two people writing something is obviously different than one person writing something. Do you think the book would have one voice, or would the two of us speak in our own voices, or it could be both maybe?
It could be something like what you did with Seeking Social Democracy, where it's like there are
dialogues.
Yeah, well, honestly,
well, let's have a Socratic dialogue about Mouse Hunt.
Each of us like writes a sort of essay component for each chapter, and there's a back and forth.
I'm Socrates. Will, don't you understand? Statecraft is like a horse.
I was thinking that the book would sort of be like, I'm Ed Broadbent in this situation, where the book's kind of about like my thinking and like, you know, how the ideas that I've developed through the course of my career apply for today. And then you could sort of interview me about me.
Right. You know, I think it would be interesting. There are definitely different ways to approach this, right? So I believe what you and Justin did with your Important Cinema Club book was, you know, you each took like essays, right?
Yeah.
Because there are two voices on the show. I think that would be interesting to do, but I think conceptually the most interesting would be a sort of, yeah, uniform book like you're talking about, where, yeah, we're writing a book, you know, we write it together. And I honestly think the only sort of possible obstacle to something like that is just that takes more time and energy to pull off.
Well,
and,
I mean, if you want to talk about like how much money would we make on this book,
So that's a second thing.
This
right?
would have to be for love.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. And I mean, the thing here is, right, like these maybe less ambitious incarnations of this we're talking about, those I feel like would be in a stronger position to be like, it's like, here, folks, Michael and us, the book. If we're trying to write a serious book, I feel like we probably wouldn't want to make like in the front window of the shop, like on the cover, it wouldn't be like Michael and us, the book. It wouldn't be like Will and Luke, hosts of the Michael and Us podcast.
Well, you see, that's kind of where I disagree, because I like the idea of the Michael and Us book in the shop of a window, because if we're not getting money, what we are getting is, look, some small publisher said Michael and Us is a brand that we can hang our hat on.
If we want to find a publisher for this, I don't think this will actually be a problem. I mean, we're both published authors, right? So I don't think this will be a problem. But it's just a question of like, are we going to have the bandwidth and time to do it while we're also doing the things that we need to do to our, you know, pay our fucking bills and all the rest of it. Right. So if you're listening to this and you're like,
and for a writing project, a goddamn writing project, something that we do that's not the podcast, are we going to want to be together in a fucking room the whole time and like in some way making our vision compatible with another person's? Because the writing sphere is where the two of us get to be entirely ourselves.
That's right. And I mean, we, you know, like we have different prose styles, we have different ways that we approach ideas and that kind of thing, or you know, articulating our ideas. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. What would be the, you know, what is the dialectical synthesis of our prose styles look like? I'm not really sure. That would be something we'd have to think about. I mean, one way to write collaboratively is that you each write different things kind of separately, and then you get together, and then you kind of,
I think that's the most practical. Uh-huh. That would be what would have to happen. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, yeah, if you're a publisher or an acquisitions editor at a publisher listening to this, just, you know, give us $25,000-$50,000 advance, US or British pounds, you know, preferably the latter, actually.
In cash, if possible.
Yeah,
in a briefcase.
That's right. And we'll...
And maybe you'll get a book. Who knows?
You will definitely get a book if that's what the contract says. Yeah, and we'll take no less than 70% of the royalties as well, 70% on every copy sold. But no, I mean, seriously, we would very much like to do this. I mean, this is actually the first time that the two of us have talked about it to each other in this level of detail. And I actually am now more encouraged to do it because clearly both of us have sort of started writing it in our heads already. So I have no doubt that we could pull it off. But yeah, as we've been saying, really the biggest obstacles are time and unfortunately money as well, because writing a book is a lot of work and it's hard to imagine we could ever get more than a few $1,000s as an advance for something like this, or frankly that it would ever have more than, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 potential readers, you know?
When the Important Cinema Club Journal was written, it began, as most of my projects began, as a joke, where it was sort of like, what if this podcast had a book? And then it eventually turned into something bigger.
How many pages was it in the end?
A little over 100 pages. I mean, it was certainly a lot of work.
How long did it take you guys?
Probably like 8 months in total, I would guess. Every now and then somebody will ask us, do you want to do volume 2 of that? And I always think, yeah, I'd love to. I mean, find me fucking 6 months to do a thing I've already done and give me some money for it. And then it'd be nice. I mean, a book is, as you know, really labor intensive. And it's like living in a house, you know?
It consumes basically your entire life. I remember, you know, Owen Jones once likening it to, like, if you have a book, I mean, it's like your brain is pregnant, honestly. And it's just like this thing that you're being pulled inexorably towards that just, yeah, increasingly, like, you just have to, like, change your daily habits. You have to change everything in your life until it's done. I remember Canadian journalist Susan Delacourt, who I helped her do research for her book, I guess more than 10 years ago now, Shopping for Votes. And I remember, you know, it wasn't the first book she'd written. And I remember her describing what her experience with books was, where first it's my book, and then it's my fucking book, and then it's my goddamn fucking book. And I can't remember where the trajectory went after that. There were a few more levels, but yeah, that's kind of been my experience as well. You know, it's very strange because, you know, the further you get into a book, in my experience anyway, with both the Dead Center and with, you know, our work on Seeking Social Democracy, the further you get into it, the more structure it has, the more that's been written, all the rest of it, the more immersed I become and the more enthusiastic I become, the more zeal I develop for things. And actually, you start having secondary problems that you don't anticipate. So I've definitely wasted time, not just on books, but on other long form writing, where you get so immersed in something that you end up obsessing over kind of mundane details. And you might spend like 2 days trying to chase down some particular thing. And then, you know, either like getting a paragraph perfect or finding some particular detail, some document you need or something. And then actually, by the time you finished, you've like, this is like one sentence. This is actually not that important. I did not need to go on like an Odysseus scale odyssey in order to fucking like do this. It's a waste of time. But there is something really weird that happens when you're in like the late, mid or late stages of working on a big project like a book, where for me anyway, there's more zeal. There's more excitement. There's more becoming like feverishly evangelical about like whatever the subject matter is. But then also there's just like more like frustration in a way, because you know how much work it is to do a single chapter and you got this many chapters to go and this is going to be with you until you're finished and you cannot escape it.
Something like this happened to me when I was assembling my little project Moturn on Moturn about Matt Farley and Charlie Roxburgh, which was another book project that began as a joke, sort of, where it was like, it was a pandemic project. And I was like, wouldn't it be funny if there was a Bergman on Bergman style book about Matt Farley? And like the inspiration was Peter Kaplowski and Justin were doing this screening series in collaboration with the Spectacle Theater in New York of all their movies on a Twitch stream. This was at the start of the pandemic. And I think Charlie said in the chat, somebody said, why is this character who's not married have a wedding ring? And Charlie said, better to keep the wedding ring on than lose an hour of a shooting day trying to find a lost ring.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is the kind of insight that needs to be between the pages of a book.
Yeah, that's great.
And that kind of low budget filmmaking. And over the course of, that was about a 7 or 8 month project as well. Like, right. we were talking to them in these long interviews every weekend.
Moturn on Moturn is quite an achievement, honestly.
In some ways, it's the thing I'm proudest of, you know?
I think it's a remarkable achievement and a great book. And I think that you and Justin found somebody who's a very interesting artist, very unusual sort of artist. And I feel like you really gave him his due. And I'm interested to hear that, you know, you sort of began it as a joke. And then once you'd finished it, like, you're now, you know, it's like the thing that you're maybe most proud of. And I think you're right to feel that way, because maybe it started as a joke, but you guys wrote a real book. And in the same way that, like, hopefully this is fair to say, you know, Matt Farley probably started a lot of his projects, particularly the early ones, as just like, I'm going to have fun with my friends. And then over time, he built this vast, expansive universe, these films that were made for very little money and yet have, like, you know, a powerful internal logic and cosmology unto themselves.
Well, the kernel of it that's, like, not a joke is I do genuinely have a deep respect for and love for their work and what they've achieved.
Yeah.
But over the course of doing the interviews, it's like there's a real story here. First of all, the whole book, it's all taking place against the backdrop of huge shifts in terms of the business and technology of making and dispersing art like this. So it's like you find out that Charlie did an internship at that movie studio that made Time Chasers. You know Time Chasers, the Mystery Science Theater classic?
I don't know if I ever saw that one.
Yeah.
I've heard of it.
It's a Vermont-based movie studio called, I think, Edgewood.
Right.
So it's like you're following the backdrop of, like, low-tier, like, film production, low-budget film festivals. At some point in the 2000s, there were, like, these self-distribution platforms like CD Baby or, you know, Netflix DVDs, where it's like, yeah, you know, like, Netflix had 30 copies of our movie that, sure, nobody rented them, but, like, you're following that evolution. But then you're also following the friendship of these two guys who, like, at some point in college were like, making movies is something we do. It's so important. And, like, it doesn't get easier as you get older, you know? You get more and more responsibilities. You get families and mortgages. And then all the people who are doing, like, unpaid labor for you, like your friends and family and uncles and aunts, it's like, oh yeah, what if they decide not to show up for the day? Or, like, they get kids. And it's like, it gets harder to get them to be supporting actors in your movies, you know?
Okay, but so this prompts another thought in me, which is something, again, I've thought about this as a joke, but I'm honestly, like, a little more than half serious about this. The Michael and Us movie, right? Like, I want to make Local Legends, but for Michael and Us.
Okay, we got
autobiographical film.
Jonah Hill and Jesse Eisenberg star as Will and Luke, two podcasters who have to save the local community center from a big developer, you know? That's if we sell the movie rights for multi-millions of dollars, which I want to do. If there are any film big, if Steven Spielberg is listening, please, the movie rights are for sale and they're at very negotiable.
Well, I think that the crux of a movie like that, you know, saying that as if it's like a real possibility, which, you know, maybe, but, and it's coming out even in this conversation because, you know, we literally did start this podcast, if not as a joke, I mean, just as like a fun little thing that we thought a few dozen people would listen to. And, you know, neither of us were at all known as writers, you know, let alone podcasters or anything else at that time. And I don't know, it's like gradually, but also like in some ways kind of suddenly as well, it's gone from like, you know, you and I will get commissions because somebody who listens to the podcast is an editor somewhere, or maybe I venture to Windsor, Ontario, and there's, you know, people who listen to the podcast who don't actually necessarily know very much about the book I'm there to promote, but they listen to the pod and, you know, they come over or whatever.
The people who started listening in 2016 invested when this was penny stocks, and now they've paid most of their mortgage.
That's right. But so, I mean, I do think that it's like a very odd trajectory for the two of us to have around like something that started as like a quasi ironic, like Michael Moore based podcast in like the weaning days of the first Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. And I mean, there's something that happens, you know, or that has happened, I would say, along the way, which is as the podcast gets bigger in terms of, you know, in terms of people listening, but I more mean, in, you know, conceptually, is like it develops a logic unto its own. And as people, I guess, develop a relationship with the show and with us through listening, you know, I mean, there must be hundreds of hours of Michael and Us at this point. That changes the actual act of doing the podcast and conceiving episodes of the podcast, because in a sense, we become characters. I'm always a little anxious to put it that way, because I genuinely don't want to make it sound like, you know, like Will and I joke about like, oh, our Jagger Richards relationship and we have separate dressing rooms. And it's like, we very much are still friends. And you know, we're better friends probably than we were when we started the podcast, because we now have this like blood pact. We have this relationship with a specter whose name is Michael. You know, our own version of Mark Fisher's Hauntology is like the first season of this show. So, I mean, I'd actually be curious to know what you think about this. But, you know, becoming, you know, characters is not quite the right word. But another word that might be apt here, which is, again, not as precise as I would like, is brands, honestly. And here I'm not just talking about podcasting. I'm talking about like there are certain ideas that become associated with you, or certain, I don't know, bits of writing, certain podcast, maybe. Like, I'll tell you what a big moment for me was. A listener recently asked about, you know, turning point episodes on the show. And I'll tell you, a turning point moment of sorts in my career as a writer was when The Atlantic Magazine invited me to write a semi-autobiographical piece, or I should say a heavily autobiographical piece, about the Dead Center and its genesis and the genesis of the ideas in it. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, that means something, where like my own, like the way I myself was politicized and the way I have documented that and articulated that to other people, that's enough to sustain a piece now. Like a magazine is interested in that. Do you know what I'm saying here? And so that's a blessing, obviously. It's something that is exciting, but it's also, to go back to what I was saying earlier, a kind of Rubicon that's crossed that I don't think you can traverse again necessarily, or maybe you can if your, you know, career ends in failure, which is certainly a possibility.
I will say that the experience of podcasting is very different now when we've achieved a certain modest amount of success, and that people have listened that have been in positions to give us work, than it did in 2016 when we were two bozos. The fact that I've been recognized on the street is pretty fucked up.
Right. But if I can just probe a little bit more on this point, because I am very interested in what your relationship to this is. When something like, I don't know, your autobiography, like the particular way in my case you may have experienced the night Barack Obama was elected in 2008, and like the various relationships that you've developed with that particular moment over the years, like when something like that becomes a public narrative, if you know what I mean.
Actually do know what you mean.
You know,
yes.
Like that is very different from just like that as an anecdote that you might talk about to people, you might explain or expound upon to people at a party after you've had two or three beers. You know what I'm saying?
It makes it kind of unreal, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it gives it an uncanny quality.
It changes your relationship to it as well, right?
Yeah,
or it risks doing that, and you have to be very careful about that, because then there are these...
Well, it might become shtick. It might become wisdom.
It might become shtick, and you might actually end up... I think you have to really guard against this. You might end up like curating it in retrospect, and in like the worst incarnation of that, right? And you see this with like people who are actually famous, where, you know, there's some like element of their backstory that when they first talked about it, it was a minor element. And then as people respond to it, and as it becomes like maybe more useful to them in a cynical way, they blow it out of all proportion. They airbrush certain parts of it.
Well, when I saw an ad for, and God love him, but when I saw an ad for Werner Herzog doing a masterclass, and like the first couple of minutes was him being like, I was born in a remote Bavarian village and never saw a film until I was, right. Or like I saw him on Seth Meyers a few weeks ago,
right,
promoting his autobiography, and he's like full salesman mode in a way that if you look up his appearance on Letterman in 1982 to promote Fitzcarraldo, he's not like that,
right.
But he's become much slicker over the years. So he's like, people say that some of this may not be possible, but it is true. There is footage of I pull a ship over a mountain.
Right.
I did, you know.
Actually, just on that particular point, there's a really interesting section that you may remember from his recent memoir. Herzog talks about the story of Fitzcarraldo, right? And how, I'm forgetting who it was that worked on the film, but it was the guy who had the engineering expertise to actually like pull the boat over the mountain. And Herzog explains that his way of talking about this story, it sounds like, has destroyed his relationship with this guy. But I actually think that his explanation of why he started framing it in those terms is like, I pulled a ship over a mountain, actually does make sense. And I do want to maybe defend him a little bit here. I mean, you say he's become slicker, and the thing is, you have to, right? You have to, because the bigger that his reputation as a filmmaker gets...
I'm not even really saying that to disparage him.
I know you're not. I just think this is a useful case study here that you know, speaks more to what I was saying before. Herzog has to, like, certain things have to become shtick for him, right? Because this is just a purely instrumental thing. Because imagine Werner Herzog does a movie, like, basically like from the mid-70s onward. Imagine how many interviews he's doing for that movie. And you have to then have certain, like, buttons you push. That's not the right expression, but there's certain phrases that you're going to repeat. There's certain like themes and concepts. There's going to be certain ways of like talking about it that you're going to have to repeat.
But this is what I'm talking about with that Rubicon crossing you mentioned. It's like at a certain point when that thing is your life, and that thing is things that have happened to you, like you develop a strange relationship with your own life and your own experiences when they become those buttons.
That's right. I mean, that happened with the Dead Center, honestly. When I was promoting that and I was doing interviews around that, It actually took me a little while to figure out. I mean, this is, I guess, like, you do this once and then you figure this out. But it took me a little while to figure out, like, okay, I do need to have, like, talking points around this book, because there's certain things that basically in any interview they're going to ask me. And, like, you can save yourself a lot of work, a lot of time, and a lot of trouble by just being like, okay, like, what do I actually think about that question? And how do I want to explain this to people? And there are, like, certain instrumental calculations that you make in that, because obviously you want to present your work. If you're promoting a goddamn book, you want to present it in the best possible light. And I'd never had to think about those kinds of things before. And that was an unusual experience for me, you know? But so just to finish the Herzog point, I do want to defend him a little bit on this Fitzcarraldo thing, because as he says in the book, when I said I pulled a ship over a mountain, like, he doesn't put it like this, but I think he's being honest here. It's basically like, I was using it to represent the megalomaniacal drive that caused me to create Fitzcarraldo. And of course, the pulling of the ship over the mountain is like the central metaphor of the film, and is like a metaphor for the making of the film itself.
By the way, as Harry Truman said to Oppenheimer, I was the one who dropped the bomb, not you.
Right. That's right. But so you can see in Herzog's memoir all the ways that he's had to grapple with, like, the aspects of his own biography that have become shtick. And instead of just, like, writing a hack book, I thought he did, as I'm going to argue in my piece, as I did argue in my piece, he did something more interesting, which is he approached writing a memoir in the same way that he approaches creating a film. He talks about his own biography in terms of the ecstatic truth of that biography, and he creates a sort of a mythical account of his own life. I frankly think that's a lot better than what he might have done, and honestly, what I was kind of expecting. And I don't say that to disparage Herzog, but just because that's often what this type of book is. So all of this is really just to say that when it comes to writing or podcasting, or I suppose just having any kind of, like, public-facing profile that, you know, gets bigger over time, it does change your relationship to things in a way that can be perhaps kind of uncomfortable, a kind of uncanny, kind of strange. And if we made a Michael and Us movie, when we make the Michael and Us movie, that would have to be in some ways the backbone of it. Like, there must be a version of Local Legends that's can be found in that, but, like, for us, you know what I mean?
Yeah, what's the version of Local Legends that's between Local Legends, where he doesn't become famous, right, at the end, on the one hand, but then also the Great Man biopic where he does become famous on the other? What's the one that's somewhere in between and much closer to Local Legends on the spectrum, where he becomes famous enough that he's recognized in public upwards of four times a year?
Yeah. The other template is something like My Dinner with Andre, because what they did with that film, as I understand it, the genesis of that is that they literally did have a whole bunch of conversations for like a year. And then they synthesized the conversations into, like, again, the ecstatic truth of those conversations. And then they wrote a film around it where, you know, they're kind of people who've known each other in the past. And as Wally says at the beginning, you know, he's got this dinner with somebody he honestly doesn't even really like. And Wallace Shawn, you know, was a successful person in his life when he made My Dinner with Andre, but, you know, Wally in the film is a guy who, you know, grew up with privilege, right? But then he's just kind of like writing plays and stuff, and, you know, he doesn't have a lot of money. And so in some ways it's a version of himself that is in some ways true, but, you know, has been sort of torqued and altered in interesting ways for narrative purposes. And I genuinely think we could do that with this podcast. Like, there are so many different ways that occur to me how we could do that. And I think that might be fun, because there'd be a lot of creative freedom in it, because we could just, like, we could write ourselves, you know what I mean? We could write each other. And I feel like that could be fun.
Yes, I'd like to see you write a version of me, and then I could write a version of you. You'll find out what you're really like.
There's more.
Detonator charged.
There's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world.
We're in a race against the Nazis. I have no choice.
Is it big enough
to end the war?
To end the war.
It's happening, isn't it?
One. Oppenheimer in theaters July 21st. Rated R.
Well, listen. Speaking of great man biopics, I mean, we couldn't leave this episode with just some self-indulgent talk about the Michael and Us movie.
No, on this show, we would never be self-indulgent.
I do want to probe you about a movie that you watched last night and that I have already seen, or you watched it two nights ago. Not that it matters. Not that anyone's fact-checking what night we could just make up. It's, this is our forum. We bend reality.
Yeah, I haven't even seen it.
But you watched Oppenheimer, which I've seen, by Christopher Nolan, who in the past has not been one of your favorite directors. Frankly, hasn't been one of my favorite directors either.
It's funny to refer to a Christopher Nolan movie as like by Christopher Nolan. But in this case, it's applicable.
Would you disagree? I mean, he's a man whose fingerprints are all over his movies.
No, I don't. It's just, imagine you said that about Batman Begins by Christopher Nolan. You know what I mean?
See, I don't think that's crazy, because Christopher Nolan is one of the few mass market auteurs. Like, he's one of the few guys, along with, you know, Quentin Tarantino and a couple others, James Cameron, Steven Spielberg, who sell a movie on their name still and sell a movie on their style. People know what they're getting with a Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah, but within mass market auteurs, like, there's a spectrum and some of them are better than others, right?
Well, this is a qualitative judgment.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he's the best, but right. I'm saying that, like, you look at The Dark Knight, you look at Dunkirk, you look at Inception. These are movies by the same guy.
Okay.
By a man of a strong vision that I often object to.
Fair enough. I guess it's more laughing at the idea of, like, when you say by, it's kind of like you're talking about literature. So that formulation applied to, like, The Dark Knight Rises is just, there's something inherently funny to me about that.
Hey, John Grisham writes books.
Yeah. But no, look, I don't know why I'm, like, disparaging Christopher Nolan. When you bring up Oppenheimer, a film that I agree, his fingerprints are all over it, and I did quite like it. I think Christopher Nolan is at his best when he reins in some of the instincts that he often leans into a little bit too much. I think the first act of certain Christopher Nolan movies, you know, it's insanely convoluted. You know, you think about Inception or something like that. It's like, okay, we need to build an elaborate system of rules, and then the rest of the film is going to be us executing those rules. Like, the first act is, here's all the lore that you need to understand before the rest
Tenet
of the movie
has
makes
some
sense.
Some of that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, now I think I like Tenet better than you. I mean, Tenet to me is a kind of like wonderfully convoluted thriller. I don't want to exaggerate how good I think it is, but that was one where, honestly, like, I'm not going to see that a lot of my life. I might see it a second time at some point just for fun. But it's not as good as Christopher Nolan when he's good. And when he's good is Memento, right? Which I saw for the first time. Will made fun of me because it's like a dorm room ass movie. Like, I'm expounding on, have you seen Memento?
It's a good movie, though.
No, it's really good. And that movie honestly showcases what Christopher Nolan does the best and what he has a genuine talent for, which is, I'm going to use a word that is becoming an overused one in my lexicon and is perhaps lent on a little too much in the nomenclatura of the Michael and Us podcast, but there's a kind of ecstatic narrative structure that he's very good at, right? Memento famously has this kind of like elliptical structure. It's quite ingenious, really.
Well, he's good at a kind of puzzle box. Like,
that's right.
Like, oftentimes his movies have that kind of satisfying click sound at the end when everything clicks into place.
Yes, and Memento, you know, it works particularly well because there's still a fair bit of room for interpretation and things like that. But Oppenheimer does this quite brilliantly, and it does not do the thing I expected it to do, where, like, yeah, the first hour is, I don't know, yeah, setting up some kind of elaborate schema around quantum physics that then the rest of the film, like, that becomes the narrative structure in some way. Like, that's not what happened here, but it is a very disjointed narrative, and I don't say that in a bad way. It's a fractured narrative that is united by other things besides its linearity, or held together by other things besides its linearity. The film had a more jaundiced view of, like, the U.S. military, the U.S. security state than I was expecting. I like that.
Well, the reason that I want to talk about Oppenheimer, and I feel like maybe we can dispense with the whole plot synopsis, because this is a very popular movie that everyone knows. Robert Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, he's making the atomic bomb, folks, and he's conflicted about it. And also, they want to take his security pass away because he's a goddamn communist. There's a lot that's interesting to me about this movie. First of all, I like the movie. It's very entertaining, and, you know, it moves like a freight train, and it has some interesting ideas in it. And technically, it's, you know, superlative, as Nolan's films always are. Nolan is a liberal, basically. That's how I would read him. Again, I don't say that to disparage him. I'm just sort of describing him.
Well, he's a liberal, you mean, in the sense that, like, almost anybody, apart from a few very exceptional cases, almost anybody in his kind of position in culture is sort of a liberal, given that being a liberal describes the median set of cultural and political commitments and the sort of the spectrum of ideas that someone in his position would almost certainly necessarily hold.
100%. And so you look at a movie like The Dark Knight Rises, they are sort of the products of a reactionary liberal mind in the late Bush, early Obama eras. You know, they're articulating a right-leaning liberal's ambient fears.
Yeah.
because he's one of the mass market auteurs, one of his jobs, one of his points of interest is sort of synthesizing the ambient fears and anxieties of the current moment and presenting them to us. And this movie, which resonated so strongly when it was in theaters this summer, it's interesting to chart the political progression, the received wisdom, the ambient wisdom that a prestige blockbuster is selling us compared to 20 years ago, compared to what Charlie Wilson's War looked like, for instance.
God, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Rancidly reactionary.
Which you know, Charlie Wilson's War was already just a little bit out of the zeitgeist when it came out in 2007. But if they made Charlie Wilson's War today, it would be laughed off the screen.
I love that Tom Hanks fucking intervened to be like, we can't show like what the outcome of this, like Charlie Wilson's like entire project was, because that would be like too sad and it would discredit the film and it would discredit me, frankly, and I'm not down for that.
Whereas this is a movie where, you know, they spend the whole movie building the Manhattan Project, and as it's going on, there are increasing misgivings among the team about, well, look, the war is basically won. People are signing petitions, circulating petitions about, okay, we built this thing, but for God's sake, don't drop it.
Yeah, I'm like, do you fucking understand what this will do if we drop it on people?
Now, when I was a kid in the 90s, the ambient received wisdom was that dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a necessary evil.
Well, and did you know the firebombing of Tokyo actually killed more people? That was a talking point you used to hear a lot.
And it was necessary because it was the decisive end of the war. The Japanese were going to fight to the last man. That was what was being said. And this movie has a scene, I can't remember which one, but one of the mucky mucks, they're all sitting around and the guys, they're talking about which Japanese cities to bomb. And the guy
who's got an arbitrary list of 9 or 10. And then he's like, actually, it's going to be 9 because...
My wife and I honeymooned in Kyoto, and it's quite lovely. And that's such a chilling scene. Like that's a scene that's worthy of Nolan's hero Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, I mean that scene is I agree, that really stuck out for me too, and if I'm following you, I mean I think you're right to imply that that scene would not have been in a movie like 10 years ago, or definitely not 15 years ago, right?
Well, it's crazy, like or when Forrest Gump came out, right? Like quintessential drink end of history movie. This is not an end of history movie because it ends with Oppenheimer saying like we destroyed the world. There's still this malignant force, which is the bomb. And you wouldn't have had that message in a movie from the 90s where it basically said, yeah, we have the bomb, but we've got it all figured out. There's a US-led world order, and, you know, it could be used. It'll be used for bad actors if they ever really get out of hand, but only when it has to be, and you can trust us with it. And that's not the message of this movie. This movie is saying, you know, sooner or later, this bomb will blow up in our face.
And this scene as well, like, the depiction, you know, I think a realistic one of how, like, state violence, even on this scale, like, you know, it's often thought of as something that's sort of coldly rational, right? That's like power, when it reaches a sufficient size, applies itself in a sort of like non-discriminating sort of way, perhaps to destructive ends. But what this scene shows is actually, no, there's still like a deep arbitrariness to how power is applied by something like, you know, the U.S. National security apparatus, military apparatus. Like even something on the scale of the military-industrial complex is subject and conditioned by the arbitrary whims of individual people, which speaks to the wider thesis of the film, really, which is that you actually should not, we should not create structures of power, whether that's in terms of, you know, militarized states or inventions like the A-bomb or the H-bomb. We should not be creating structures of power or objects of power on that scale at all, because they will be subject to human whims, and that makes them inherently sinister and dangerous because human beings are flawed creatures. If a bunch of jarheads sitting around in a room, literally just like spitballing in a tone as casual as like Will and I talking out what the next episode of the podcast is going to be. Yeah, which city on this arbitrary list of like Japanese cities that we've heard of and may or may not be significant military targets, which of these cities are we going to drop a bomb on that at minimum is going to kill like 50 to 70,000 people or something? And if a decision like that can be subject to like, oh, well, my wife and I summered in Kyoto and it's lovely, so let's not go there, let's scratch that one off the list. That is so objectively terrifying. Yeah, that to me is the real thesis of the movie.
You think anyone in Hiroshima or Nagasaki gives a shit who built the bomb? They care who dropped it. I did.
I should say, I think there are a lot of good artistic decisions in the movie. For example, the decision to not show the actual bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's that very haunting, I think, shot of the trucks taking the bombs away, which has really lingered with me in a way that, like, images in Nolan's movies don't usually linger with me like that. All the significance of that. And then later, when Oppenheimer is giving that speech, and there's the kind of, like, dream component in it of him sort of, like, feeling the blast.
Yeah.
That's one of several abstract touches that Nolan brings, which I think he brings with mixed results, but
some of them don't always work.
But I admire the effort for the most part, because he's such a literal-minded filmmaker for the most part.
Can I tell you one I didn't like that actually follows directly from that? I mean, so there's that final shot, which I guess was used in, or it's like the penultimate shot, which I guess was used in a lot of the marketing for the movie, which is just a close-up of Cillian Murphy's face, right? I wish Nolan had not included that shot, like after he says to Einstein, spoiler, you know, that whatever the conversation is, they have a back and forth about we're worried we're going to destroy the world. And he says, well, I think that we did or something. And then there's the shot of like the atmosphere basically like catching on fire. I wish that shot hadn't been in the movie. It's too literal. I actually didn't like that. There's some other flourishes in that sequence where, do you remember the scene earlier in the movie where there's like the guy explaining when he was like flying in a Spitfire and he saw a V2 rocket? This is at the end of the movie. Oppenheimer is the guy in the Spitfire and he's looking at the V2. See, that I like, but the actual kind of apocalyptic shot that Nolan felt like he had to finish the movie with, I guess that's maybe not an abstract touch, but maybe in some ways it is. And I don't know, it was too literal to work for me.
But getting back to my friendly criticism of the movie, like I say, Nolan's not a radical, and you can see in his film sort of the limits of the liberal imagination. And a lot is invested in this movie about whether Oppenheimer himself is basically a good man, basically a righteous man. And I mean, it's compelling drama. Murphy is excellent in the role.
Yeah, he's really good.
The whole structuring drama of him being interrogated for his communist affiliations and whether or not they're going to take his security pass, like it works on the level of drama. But at the end of the day, who cares if he was a good man? Who cares if during and after the building of this bomb, he thought it was a good idea?
Yeah, he was sad about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, that's kind of a liberal touch. You know what I mean? And I say this in a friendly way because I do find it compelling on the level of drama. Do you really care about if Monsieur Verdoux cared about the people that he killed? You know, that feels like a much more, like an interesting version of this movie, not necessarily a more dramatically satisfying one, but a more radical version of this movie is one that frees itself of any concern about whether or not Oppenheimer personally, morally redeemed himself, or whether his crusade after the dropping of the bomb to limit its use mattered. Like, what really matters is the bomb was made and it was dropped and it still exists. In fact, when Harry Truman says to him, "You didn't drop the bomb, I did," he's making a good, I think, meta-textual point as well, where it's like, yeah, Oppenheimer doesn't really matter. It's the state that matters.
You know, there was one particular exchange in the movie that I really liked. And again, I feel like this is something that you would not have seen in a movie like this 10 or 15 years ago. There's an exchange between Murphy as Oppenheimer and Florence Pugh as Jean. This is, I think, quite early in the movie, you know, when Oppenheimer is going to one of those like CPUSA like meet and greets or whatever. And Oppenheimer asks her, "Why limit yourself to one dogma?" And she replies, "You're a physicist. Do you pick and choose rules, or do you use the discipline to channel your energies into purpose?" And he says, "I like a little wiggle room. You always toe the party line." And she says, "I like my wiggle room too." And I think this is actually like pretty brilliant script writing. And I love what it's conveying as well, possibly just because it addresses a pet peeve of mine in that I feel like to a certain type of liberal or centrist interlocutor that I've had in the past, like they just look at someone like me and they actually don't understand wanting to associate yourself with an ideology at all, whether that's socialism or anything else, because they see it exactly as Oppenheimer is seeing it at the beginning of this exchange. For them, political ideas are something you can pick and choose. It's a banquet. Just like pick the good ones. Why limit yourself to one ideology? Why not go beyond left and right? And Jean's response here, where she says, you know, "You're a fucking physicist. Like, you're concerned with rules. You're concerned with structure, with uncovering, in his case, the basic structures of reality. So like, you can't pick and choose either." And that's exactly what I think about ideology. But the second half of the exchange also gets at something important. If we're talking about something like the CPUSA, there were a lot of people who were, members of the CPUSA who had a very sort of an overly, an excessively scientific view of socialism. They weren't the only ones in the first half of the 20th century or so who thought that, just as we have empirical science that can uncover, the laws of physics or something, we can apply that to the laws of history. And that's why Comrade Stalin can make the perfect five-year plan that brings us, within another 5 years of like full international socialism and human brotherhood and utopia, etc. And that's the point, right, where ideology can actually really shackle you when you don't have wiggle room, when it becomes dogma. So I actually think this very simple exchange is a pretty nuanced little discussion of ideology. And the response Florence Pugh gives to Cillian Murphy in the scene is not something I think you would have found in a film 10 years ago, or perhaps even 5 or 6 years ago, because the point of the scene, if the film had been made then, would have been, she's the bad guy. Oppenheimer understands you can't limit yourself to one ideology because therein lies dogma and tyranny. And this scene is a lot more nuanced in how it thinks about those questions.
Before we leave the subject of this movie forever, I do want to ask you about a little senator from New England.
Oh, God.
Named John F. Kennedy.
Wow, we're talking about, this isn't a friendly criticism. I hated this.
That's such a Nolan touch, isn't it? To have that little moment at the end where it's like, you should use your real name, Robin. That little final cheap...
There has to be this bullshit, like the right at the end of the movie where Robert Downey Jr. is like, the film, it gives you this little emotional payoff and that, Robert Downey Jr. doesn't get to be Commerce Secretary. Which, I was happy to see, but whatever. Again, I feel like that's just in there because you need some kind of emotional payoff at the end of the film. But as you were saying before, it's kind of like, how much is really at stake in that?
This is where Nolan's kind of more liberal instincts kick in, where it's like, he has to give you some satisfaction of justice being done at some point.
Absolutely.
Like the part where Oppenheimer gets his belated tribute at the White House years later when he's no longer a threat, that scene rings very true. But there also has to be the part where it's like, well, don't worry. Somebody who cruelly caused his downfall had to pay for it. And it's this Robert Downey Jr. character, because the system will right itself.
Yeah.
Particularly if there's an ambitious young senator.
Right. So all that stuff about like the Robert Downey Jr. plot, that is a friendly criticism I want to make clear. But the particular flourish Will is talking about in the movie drove me fucking insane. And look, I feel actually quite privileged that I find the Kennedy myth so impenetrable and like Kennedy nostalgia so impenetrable. I'm very glad that I am immune to it.
Well, you gotta understand, he was the hottest president that they'd ever had.
Dude, like,
and he was
Mayor fucking Quimby.
He was at most
sex symbol.
He was a four, if you ask me.
But I don't know. Yeah, there's this thing at the end where, Johnny Jr.'s aide is telling him, there were a few last minute no votes to your confirmation. He's like, who was it? And the guy's like going through his list. He's like, let's see. Well, there's this this young senator from Massachusetts. And as soon as I heard that, I'm like, God damn it, man.
Senators, congressmen, please heed the call.
Yeah, right. And it's like, let's see. It's John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And I was like, geez. Give me a fucking break. The people who are not immune from the Kennedy nostalgia, they just can't help themselves. And
well, the idea that Kennedy represents in some way some radical break with the old order.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, Kennedy, it's especially funny in a context where the thesis of the movie is that like the A-bomb splitting the atom is like, that's a Rubicon that's crossed and you can't go back. And it's like, Kennedy's a real threat to the fucking A-bomb, a guy who during the Cuban Missile Crisis like helped bring the world closer to nuclear war than maybe any other figure in modern history. I don't know. I've heard they're working on a vaccine for Kennedy nostalgia, but so far it's beyond the reach of our scientists.
Don't worry, within the next 10 years, it's going to take a huge hit. Within the next 10 or 15 years, the Kennedy nostalgia industry will be going the way of, the Buddy Holly nostalgia industry. What are some other figures who have kind of aged out?
Oh my God, you're right. There's going to be like Kennedy biopics, but they're going to have as much resonance or weight as just like those ones that come along every few years where it's like, okay, we're presenting this person to a new generation who has like no reference points for them and has like no investment in them. And they're going to be middlebrow movies that like meet often with a mixed reception and limited success at the box office.
Anyway, the Kennedy brand is strong though. There's Joe Kennedy III. There's Robert F. Kennedy. Your next president.
Well, I mean, man, he is honestly possibly going to be a factor in the presidential election because he's.
I love it.
He's now running as an independent. I don't think it's like completely outside of the realm of possibility that Trump throws a Hail Mary and asks him to be his running mate or something, and that will literally have the momentum of a runaway freight train.
Long live the new Flash.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
Well, it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy.